You're listening to Opinion Science, the show about our opinions, where they come from, and how they change. I'm Andy Luttrell. Now, normally I start things off with more of a monologue or story related to the main idea underlying the episode, but this week's interview covers so much ground about such fundamental stuff that I figured we can just get right into it, because this week I'm talking to the esteemed social psychologist Richard Nisbet. Earlier this year, he released a memoir titled Thinking. It's a personal history and traces the trajectory of his research on the psychology of reasoning and how it can go wrong. When I started this show, I never expected to be hearing from book publicists, but nowadays I'll get a fair number of inquiries from publicists or authors looking to see if I'm interested in having them on the show. Oftentimes, it's not a great fit for whatever reason, but a couple months ago, I heard from a publicist asking if I would be interested in interviewing Richard Nisbet, and I was like, yeah, of course. I was already well aware of Nisbet's work, and I'm not alone. Malcolm Gladwell said once that the most influential thinker in my life has been the psychologist Richard Nisbet. He basically gave me my view of the world. And here's why. Nisbet got his PhD in 1966 at Columbia, working with Stanley Schachter, who's another major player in the history of social psychology. After graduating from Columbia, he began as a professor at Yale before moving to the University of Michigan, where he's been since 1971. Along the way, his research has shaped the way psychologists think about introspection, errors in reasoning, how to improve reasoning, the role of culture in how we think, and intelligence. In our conversation, we covered all of that ground and more, and I'm excited to share it. I do want to mention that we had to jump through a couple technical hoops in this recording, so the audio isn't quite to the standard that I shoot for in this show, but I think you'll enjoy our conversation all the same. One quick note, though, about Nisbet's longtime collaborator Lee Ross. Although he didn't come up in this interview, in the memoir, Nisbet's affection for Lee is so clear. They had this really productive and collaborative career together, and they even published a handful of books together that have gone on to be super influential. Unfortunately, just a few days after we recorded this interview, Lee passed away. His work was great and influenced generations of social psychologists, so it just seemed prudent here to mention this, because Lee was such a prominent contributor to social psychology and a dear friend of today's guest. So, raise a glass to Lee Ross and settle in for my interview with Richard Nisbet on his long career spent thinking. So I think we can start with the Nisbet and Wilson paper, and I call it that because to me that's just the Nisbet and Wilson effect, right? That's just, that citation just stands out almost as the concept itself. And so the notion is about lacking introspective awareness about cognitive processes, which on its own, just that is a little bit of a mouthful. So maybe you could give people some sense of what that means and how you happened to across that idea.
Well, if you ask me how I voted on the new school millage proposal, I'd say, well, I value education and I think salary should be higher here. If you then, as an opinion expert, ask me, do you suppose that you were influenced in that vote by the fact that the vote was held in a school as opposed to a church or anyplace else? I would say you've got to be kidding. You think I would be influenced by something like that? But I probably was. Mm-hmm. I just don't know it. I don't have a representation of that in my decision-making process. I mean, judgment processes are like decisions in that you don't want to see how they're made because it's embarrassing, the range of things that can influence a given judgment or behavior. We don't have a representation of those things in such a way that we can tell how they're represented in the cognitive process. And we just don't have it. And many people say, oh, okay. But they don't believe that for 1 minute. They believe, like I do when I tell people why I did something, that I'm telling the truth, that I'm doing it in part on the basis of inspecting what I was thinking about at the time. But I can't see the actual cognitive processes. Now, we don't have any problem with being told that we can't see memory processes or perceptual processes. Of course we can. I can't tell you the process that went on in my retina and in my visual cortex that allowed me to see something. But the fact that we do have lots of cognitive representation allows us to think, well, we have complete cognitive representation of cognitive processes, which we absolutely do not have.
Well, what stands out to you as the best evidence of that? In some ways, it makes some intuitive sense that, yeah, well, how could I know exactly where I reached this conclusion from? But I don't know, maybe I'm right. Maybe some people are right. How do we know that people just really can't crack open the process that led to some outcome judgment decision or whatever?
Well, my favorite experiment ever was done almost 100 years ago by N.R.F. Meyer at the University of Michigan. He hung two cords from the ceiling and told the subject that his task is to tie them together. But they're too short. He can grab one and can't get the other. The room is strewn with things that can be used to do that, like an extension cord and so on. And the subjects, you know, get a lot of these things. And then after the subject has been stumped for a few minutes, Meyer, who's been strolling around the room, hits one of the ropes and sets it to swinging. Typically, then, within 45 seconds, the subject ties an object to one of the ropes, sets to swinging, grunts and grabs the other rope, and then grabs the swinging rope and ties them together. At which point, Meyer says, "That's great. How did you happen to come up with that?" And the typical answer, "I don't know. It just occurred to me." He had a lot of his subjects were psychologists who came up with answers like, "Well, I had imagery of monkeys swinging through the jungle. That the imagery occurred simultaneously with the solution." And if he asked, you know, "Do you think that the fact that I set the rope into motion had anything to do with it?" A lot of them said, "Well, I didn't see that. So that couldn't have had an influence." And so here's something going on in their heads, cognitive process. Experimenter knows what was going on. The subject is totally blind to it and denies it when the experimenter asked him. And of course, we did many, much more simple experiments. We have a line of nylon stockings to women in a mall and ask them to judge the quality. And they're four times as likely to say that the last one they examined has the highest quality than the first one they examined. And, you know, if you ask them, which we did, just, "Do you suppose your judgment of quality was influenced by the position of the pantyhose and the nylon stockings in the array?" They look at you as if one of you is crazy. Either you're crazy or I'm crazy, because that couldn't possibly have been it. So, you know, we had like dozens of experiments like that. And interestingly, we were not very good at predicting what would be the influence of the thing. We knew in advance, oh, well, you know, the nylon stocking study was actually done because we had the stockings imbued with different aromas. And we thought the aroma would influence. The aroma had no impact. We had no guess that the position thing was going to have any impact. And in general, our experiments, where we felt we had these clever expectations, which most people wouldn't guess, most psychologists would get wrong, we were wrong, and we weren't original, because everybody thought what would happen would happen. So anyway, that's the basic evidence that we drew on for the conclusion. But anyway, introspectively, if you do your introspection right, you'll realize you're missing all kinds of things that are influencing you.
Yeah, I'm glad that you mentioned the stocking study, because I was going to ask specifically about that one, because that is the one that stands out to me for whatever reason. And in part, I think it's because I've just been so curious for all these years where the thought came from that, oh yeah, people will pick based on the order that these stockings are laid out. And I just revisited the paper today to see, like, do they even say, like, oh, there's this theory of why? But it seems like, no, you were trying to do something else, like you said, with the aromas. And you discover, right? Talk about lack of knowing what goes on under the hood.
Right, exactly.
And so were you, this was like at a mall, like hundreds of people coming to a table at a mall. And were you one of the ones who was coaching people through this, or was this, were these students?
Early on, and then Tim was, was the experimenter for most of it.
I just wondered if you had any firsthand, like, witnessing people flabbergasted that they could possibly be influenced by the order.
We didn't press our luck. We just asked, you know, do you suppose you could have been influenced by that? And, you know, they gave us a funny look and said no. But we didn't ask everybody.
And so it also makes me think of, in terms of doing research on psychology, oftentimes this starts with this introspective process, or at least the process we think is introspection, right? We go, why is it that I just did this? I was just talking to Bob Cialdini a little bit ago, and he talks about how he was influenced to buy candy bars at his front door. And he had to take a moment to go, well, why is it that I did that, and concoct some sort of naive theory? But until you test it, you don't really know. So in some ways, the enterprise of being a social psychologist opens you up to say, yeah, I don't know that we do have this kind of awareness.
That's right. No, I mean, sometimes people ask me why I did this or why I think that. And if it's a social psychologist, it's remember that I'm Nisbet of Nisbet and Wilson. So what you're about to hear should not be given much credence. You can't say this to, you know, your ordinary friends. You can't say, don't trust what I say. I mean, they think you're crazy. So it's just social psychologists that I can say that sort of thing to.
I have one other question about, this is just a one-off thing from the annals of the literature, which is the paper on intrinsic and extrinsic motivations for kids wanting to engage in some activity, either because they truly want to or they were rewarded. And the only reason I bring it up is because this one methodological detail has haunted me since I came across it, which is that some of the data had to be dropped or some of the class sessions had to be skipped because of, quote, an unanticipated arrival of a goat in the classroom. Do you have any memory of this at all?
I certainly didn't have a spontaneous memory. I recognize it when you say that. So, oh, yeah, that's in the paper. I was not there for the incident. It was Mark Lepper who was there.
Gotcha. Yeah, I did. The results and conclusions are one thing and important, but I always just wonder, I need to get to the bottom of who this goat was and how I got in the classroom. Okay, so moving along a little bit, one of the things that was striking that I'd never quite taken the time to consider is the reaction to the work that you and others have done on errors in judgment and decision making. So you and others have famously documented these errors that people make when they reason, that they're swayed by some information that ought not to sway them, or they overlook information that they ought to be incorporating in their judgment. And you write in the book about this reaction to that I wouldn't have seen coming, which is not to say that these biases don't exist, but that we shouldn't be calling them errors, and that to do so is to be judging people for faulty reasoning when they think that that's not the case. So I'm curious if you could reflect a little bit on what that was like to be in the middle of, and how you would characterize this particular kind of resistance to the work that you were doing.
Well, people were taught in graduate school, we don't judge people's behavior. We don't say what's good or bad. That's just, we just work here. I mean, you know, we just report what happened. So when somebody comes along saying people make errors in their reasoning, I say, well, you know, that's for philosophers and preachers. That's not the job of psychologists. But the reaction from philosophers was stunning. I mean, these smart people, even Oxford philosophers saying, you know, you can't assert that people's reasoning is wrong, but it's correct by definition. So that was, it was shocking to see that resistance, and it went on for like a year or two until this one Oxford philosopher wrote this completely crazy paper. There was a tremendous amount of commentary from philosophers and psychologists, and I assumed that psychologists would side with us. I wasn't so sure about philosophers. In the end, you know, all psychologists side with us. So, yeah, people do make these same errors. And the great majority of the philosophers did as well.
In one sense, it seems like, yeah, it's in whose domain is it to say that this is right or wrong? But they were almost saying it's our domain, and we're saying that this is totally fine reasoning. We shouldn't call it erroneous. What could you sort of talk about why, like what they mean by that? Like, what would that mean to say we cannot call these errors in judgment if people are doing them?
Well, they made a false analogy to grammar. They said, you know, people, they can't tell you what their grammar is, and that's true. I mean, we you know, if you start asking me, what are the rules of English grammar? I just start producing gibberish. I mean, but I don't make mistakes. I mean, I very often. So they said it's that same way with reasoning. I mean, we can't necessarily say what the rules are that we use to reason, but we don't make mistakes, except rarely. And when it is, it's a glitch, and we can be corrected and we understand it. But it's just a terrible analogy, that's all.
Hey, at this point in the interview, I'm about to ask for an example of judgment errors. And Nisbet goes on to give some great examples, but they rest on two concepts that may not be super clear or familiar. So I just wanted to quickly fill you in before we get back to the interview. The first idea is the law of large numbers. It's an idea from probability and statistics. Basically, this is the notion that individual observations are volatile, but averaging across many observations gets you closer to a stable estimate of some probability. So we all know that a coin has a 50% chance of coming up heads and a 50% chance of coming up tails. If I flip a coin just 3 or 4 times, I might be way off from that 50% probability. Maybe the coin comes up heads 3 out of 4 times, or maybe even all 4 times. Based on this limited set of observations, you might think I have some extraordinary coin that comes up heads more often than not. But keep flipping the coin 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times, and you'll find that the probability of it coming up heads ends up being a very snug 50%. Nothing really changed about the coin over time that made it go from 100% heads to 50% heads. We just amassed more and more data that got us closer to the truth. But as our guest explains, people's intuitions often fail to appreciate that many observations will naturally temper what can otherwise seem like extremes. Second is the concept of the sunk cost fallacy. Here, the idea is that people continue to do something, even when it's not working out, just because they've already invested time, money, or effort. So imagine you go to a movie theater, and halfway through the movie, you realize that you hate this movie. Should you keep watching it? Well, you might think, I already paid for the ticket, I drove all the way out here, I should just sit here and finish the movie. But the ticket cost and the driving time are sunk costs. You already invested them. You're not going to get them back. So it's irrational to use those things as an excuse to keep watching a movie that you know you hate. But we do this kind of thing all the time. That's the sunk cost fallacy. Okay, hopefully that gets us all on the same page, and we can jump right back into my conversation with Richard Nisbet. Could you give an example of an error in judgment, just for folks who may not really understand like what this means that people, right? It might seem like, of course, we can't make errors in grammar, but how can we make errors in judgment according to the work that you and others have done?
Okay, great question. If you ask college freshmen early on in the term, you say, as you may know, there are frequently a lot of people early in the season, but in the baseball season, with batting averages of 350 or higher. Why do you suppose that is? That they're high, but nobody ever finishes the season with such a high batting average. And they'll say, well, I don't know, the pitchers make the necessary adjustments, or you know, maybe the guys get cocky and you know start screwing up. If you ask them at the end of college that same question, they'll say, well, you know, early in the season, there haven't been that many at-bats. And, you know, your first at-bat, your batting average is either 0 or 1. So extreme scores are more likely if the sample size is lower. Now, not everybody says that. but the majority do. And the great majority of people who had a statistics course gave you that answer. So it's an error to fail to notice that, you know, the question has embedded in it a problem in the law of large numbers. And I like that example because it shows that our reasoning is correctable. Which, by the way, early on, I did not believe. I mean, I used to say, you know, not only are we stupid, but you can't make us smarter. And that, again, came from something that somebody told me in graduate school, which is that you can't teach abstract rules of any kind. It's just, you know. So I started teaching the law of large numbers, correlation principles, cost-benefit principles. And to my astonishment, we could teach people in just a very few minutes an abstract rule like the law of large numbers, and it would apply across a huge, you know, an indefinitely large number of domains and problems, which was completely beyond what I thought was possible. And I don't know why it turned out to be so easy. I mean, like the sunk cost principle or opportunity cost concept, these are tremendously important rules of reasoning to understand, and people don't understand them in general, but you can teach them like a couple of examples and you can change people's lives. I mean, it's really important not to be trapped by some costs. And I mean, people they go to an expensive restaurant, they order a meal, they think it's going to be great, and it's lousy. And there's a lot of food, and they finish it anyway because they've got, you know, it would be wasteful to not finish the meal. Well, that's wrong. I mean, you know, you you suffer twice, once for the expensive meal and twice for eating it. You don't have to do that. You can just say to hell with it, you know. Sometimes you win, sometimes you lose. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just this, not much more than this much instruction will change the way people think. And we know by calling them up in the guise of an opinion researcher, and we give them some problem with, like, in government. And if they've been through our experiment, they'll recognize the sunk cost situation. And not always, of course, but with greater probability than if they haven't had that instruction.
And that's important too. It's not like a test at the end of the instruction, right? It's a separate domain. You would never think that, oh, this is those people calling me.
That's right. And I have this quarrel with Danny Kahneman, who says, oh, no, it's, you know, you can't, you know, somebody told him in graduate school that, you know, you can't teach people abstract rules and probability and statistics and so on, or such rules. And I said, but Danny, look, No, it's in an academic setting. If it's in an academic setting, that's the only way to live. So that's when we started, you know, pretending to be opinion researchers. Mm. And that didn't convince Danny. Don't ask me why.
I was about to.
So I don't know. It's very strange. Well, the point I make in the book, I mean, Danny, I mean, he's fabulous. He's probably the psychologist whose work I respect most of any living person. But he can be wrong. I mean, it's interesting. I mean, you're wrong about a lot of things.
Especially someone who studies errors in judgment.
That's right.
Not biases.
That's right.
So the last of your work that I wanted to talk about was your work on culture, which is actually kind of what I know you most for. So in my first year of grad school, for my winter break, I got a copy of Geography of Thought, and that was my winter break reading. And it just, that was the thing that unlocked for me what culture can do, right? And how it reshapes even the parts of psychology that you'd go, oh, well, those are the things that are just like part of how the brain works, right? Processing information and that sort of thing. And it has become now, like, anytime I teach, there's always a little module on, and here's where cultural research says that this doesn't always happen, or it works somewhat differently. And you were kind of at the forefront, as far as I can tell, of looking to culture within social psychology as an important variable. Can you talk a little bit about, like, what that turning point was like? My guess is sort of around the late 80s, early 90s is where some of that really started to take hold. you know, what was happening with culture before then, and what does it look like now?
Well, the stuff that was going on with the culture that I knew about was, you know, not very interesting. I mean, that just somebody would go do a dissonance experiment in France and it worked, or they do it in Japan and it didn't work. And I would say, oh, well, I'm Japanese, we're not trained as social psychologists. So they just don't know how to do these experiments. So that's not a very interesting finding. Or, you know, showing that opinions differ. I mean, you know, we know that attitudes and beliefs are very different across cultures. It wasn't very interesting to just demonstrate that. But I don't know actually what phenomena about culture I was convinced would show big differences in reasoning or perception. I don't recall what I first thought. But I decided I was going to do research on it. And I walked into Hazel Marcus's office one day and said, guess what, Hazel, I'm going to teach a seminar on cultural psychology. And she said, no, you're not. I am. So, of course, we taught it together. And it was the most exciting educational thing I've ever been involved in. But
and at the time, though, like what did a course like that look like? It had to look different than it looks now. Like now we have so much of that work.
That's right. Well, Hazel, I think, was beginning to get some stuff showing that there were cultural differences in self schemas, the way people thought about themselves. And I had started my work on the culture of honor. Showing that Southern males were more likely to commit murder than Northern males. And I restricted that finding to whites because I didn't want the complication of race in there. And I started with that research because I knew I was going to do research on culture. And that was a dangerous thing for white male to do. So I said, well, actually, I know some bad stuff about white males. So we'll start with that. Because I grew up in El Paso, Texas, where middle-class people shot each other. I have a relative who shot her husband. And one of the things that struck me when I went to the North is there are a lot of things I didn't like about the North. I thought people tended to be rude there. Still think that, for that matter. But it became clear to me that middle-class people didn't shoot each other. I thought, well, yeah, that's interesting. So 30 years later, I demonstrated that was the case. There was this cultural difference. It isn't really a bad thing about Southerners. I mean, it's too bad. But, I mean, they're not bad people. I mean, it's just they're stuck with this attitude about how you have to deal with insults. You have to respond with force. You know, even I have it. I mean, I just, you know, it's just stuck with it. It's our culture that made us that way. Mm-hmm.
And it stands out interestingly to me, especially for its time, that the cultural lens was sort of within the U.S., different regions, and how regional differences within a country can give rise to cultural differences, which contrasts a little bit with probably the stereotype of cross-cultural research, which is that it's all about East versus West. And I know that that has evolved, and that's not always even ever really like truly been the case, that it's all that kind of comparison. But it does strike me that that's like often what cross-cultural research boils down to in textbooks and the way that it's introduced. Do you have a sense, you talk about it a little bit, hint at why that might be the case, but is there a reason why that particular comparison took off in the research sphere?
Yep. Shinobu Kiriyama got his degree at Michigan. And he struck up a lifelong relationship with Hazel. And shortly after he graduated, they started, and they'd been having these conversations about differences between Japanese and Americans. And I had the same kind of experience. I went just by accident. I gave lectures on social psychology at Peking University in the early 80s. And there was a student there. Who could hardly speak English, but it was clear this guy was really, really smart. And several years later, he came to get a degree in psychology at Michigan. And one day he says, you know, Dick, you and I think very differently. I said, oh, yeah, tell me more. So he then essentially told me the whole deal.
Right there.
Right there. It says, you know, you think linearly, I think dialectically. You incorporate very few elements of your thought for coming up to a certain conclusion. I look at a huge range of things. So I said, well, okay, let's, I didn't really exactly believe that, but I said, let's test it. We started testing it, and it was astonishing how many different. So it started, Hazel's work and my work were based on East Asians versus Westerners. And now, of course, most of that, the grant of research that we did then and all kinds of others as well, have been extended to various countries. And now I would say the difference is between the weird countries and the non-weird countries. That refers to Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic peoples. And the great majority of other people are quite different. I mean, they're different in different ways, but sort of standard Western way of thinking that's quite different from other ways of thinking. But you can show differences. You can show, we have a student who was working with Shinobu and me, did a wonderful study looking at people in a particular Turkish village. There were three basic occupations there: farming, fishing on the open sea, and being a shepherd. Now, the first two of those occupations require substantial cooperation with other people. And I had reached the conclusion that it was this cooperative, harmonious stance that's producing the attention to the social environment and beyond that to the physical environment and the particular forms of reasoning that were characteristic of interdependent cultures. And shepherds are out there by themselves. So she showed, sure enough, the shepherds look like Westerners and the farmers and fishers look like Easterners. I mean, it's with respect to reasoning and perception. North Chinese are different from South Chinese, it turns out. North Chinese do a form of agriculture which doesn't revolve much around cooperation. Rice agriculture is massively dependent on tremendous cooperation.
Yeah, I found that wave of work to be really compelling. Or it's nice to see it given empirical attention, but this idea of, like, you know, where did these differences come from? Why would they be there? And when you look historically and say, well, you know, the pressures that are on this group for hundreds of years, thousands of years, are likely to result in having to adapt to those pressures. But by way of wrapping up, just to think big picture about some of these things, I'm curious where even the impetus to write sort of a retrospective, here's all the stuff I've done and how it happened book came from. Was there a moment where you thought, this is what I should be doing right now? What was that moment, and why did that seem like an important project?
Well, there's been such a leaving out the culture work, especially the culture of honor work. Everything else has been, it's been about thinking and reasoning about what goes on in people's heads. So there's a coherent theme in my work. And I thought, well, yeah, there's a coherent theme there. I wanted to have this, my work, to get known to a wider public, because it takes a long time for anything to leak out of academic psychology into the public, if it's ever going to. But the other thing that made me want to do it, I wanted to see if I could write prose that would qualify as having some literary value. And I succeeded in that, I believe. At any rate, Michael Lewis, the author, you probably know his work. He's the one who wrote Moneyball and who wrote a book explaining what happened in the 2008 crash, told me he'd written a New York Book Review, asking to review my book there because he really liked it very much. So I said, well, okay. I succeeded in convincing a good writer that I'd written something of some value. But so those were the two motives.
And particularly, he's someone who also, Michael Lewis, has a book on Kahneman and Tversky, right? So he knows that goal that you have of using social science in a broader in a broader sense. And Malcolm Gladwell's name on the front of the book, another person who does that. So following in footsteps, trying to bring the work that, that we do as social scientists to a more general audience.
Right. Well, both of those guys were sitting on my shoulder when I wrote while I was writing that book.
And so having taken the time to look back on your career in sort of like a from start to finish, day one to today, what advice might you have for someone either who is, you know, think about a social psych grad student or think about someone who just will never go to grad school but is curious about understanding reasoning, right? How would you encourage someone to think about questions like this?
Well, if you're going to do research, just to use the techniques of social psychology, which are incredibly powerful. And it's been interesting to me over the whole course of my career. I learned these techniques of social psychological research, and it was so clear to me that the other sciences could use that, use those techniques. I mean, economists had not a clue about how to assess it. And you might be interested to know that Dick Thaler of Nudge, he got his ideas from reading the text written by Tom Gilovich and Dacher Keltner and me about Lewin. And he said, this Lewin was just, he really knew a lot of stuff. And he drew on Lewin's ideas and Lewin's methodology and comes up with behavioral economics. People sometimes say, social psychology is sort of like behavioral economics. So yes, behavioral economics is social psychology with a name change for business reasons.
Well, I appreciate you taking the time to talk about this work and share it with a broader audience. It was great to meet you.
Good to meet you. I enjoyed it.
All right, that'll do it for another episode of Opinion Science. Thank you to Richard Nisbett for taking the time to share his work with us. His book, again, is Thinking, a Memoir. You'll find a link to the book in the show notes, along with links to some of the research we talked about and a full transcript of this episode. To learn more about this podcast, go to opinionsciencepodcast.com. You can leave a nice review on Apple Podcasts, read the other nice reviews that people have left on Apple Podcasts, follow the show on Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn. Wherever you are, it's nice to have you around. All right, and I think that's all I have to say. So thank you for listening, and I'll see you in a couple weeks for more Opinion Science. Bye-bye.